Good day, everyone, and welcome to the third day of our lecture series on contemporary South Asia. And today we have the pleasure of hearing what Dr. Minna Sävälä from the Family Federation of Finland has to say about South Asia and family and kinship there. Welcome.
Thank you, Jukka. Good day to everybody. I am here today to talk to you about changing family and kinship in South Asia. And first I would like to just briefly tell you a few words about my own background in the study of South Asian society so that you might understand my point of views and starting points to this topic. I'm a social anthropologist by background and a docent in social and cultural anthropology at the University of Helsinki, but since 9 years I've been working in an NGO, Väestöliitto, as a researcher and more recently as a head of multicultural affairs. And so during the last, let's say, half a year, I haven't been really actively engaged in doing research, but before that I was doing research as my main occupation. And then what I have done in relation to South Asia, I've been working in India. I started with my PhD study, which dealt with the fertility decline in southern India and changing family relationships in South India. And I did fieldwork there in Andhra Pradesh, which is part of South India, and worked on that for my PhD at the University of Amsterdam. And then after that, I did another project which was about middle class life in Hyderabad. Hyderabad is the state capital of, or was, well, anyway, is actually the state capital of Andhra Pradesh. That state of Andhra Pradesh has lately been divided into two, so I a little bit hesitated whether I should say it is the capital of Andhra Pradesh, but it is actually still formally also the capital of Andhra Pradesh, even though it's situated in the middle of Telangana, which is another new state there now. But anyway. So I did fieldwork there in Hyderabad among the middle class, new middle class people. And then at the moment, or during the last, let's say, few years, I've been working in a new location in India, which is Maharashtra. And I've collected, together with some other Indian colleagues, some data there in relation to family formation and marriage, especially in among the lower socioeconomic groups in slum contexts. So that is an ongoing project, which I will tell you a little bit more about later in this lecture or presentation of mine. So those are the topics I've been dealing with in the past. And now in this presentation, what I'm intending to cover in the coming 1.5 hours is that first I'm going to go through a little bit about the general key features of kinship and family in South Asia generally. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the extended family relations, a little bit about residence patterns in relation to families and households, and then actually quite a lot about marriage. Not only because I have worked on that myself in the recent past, but also because it is one of the very key features of life in South Asia. Marriage and all the issues related to that, like the choice of marriage partners, etc. Then we go a little bit further to the forces of transformation, like there are these kind of fundamental structures and practices related to kinship and family in the area, how they are transforming and what kind of forces are affecting these relations. And then further on, we will talk more about marriage, about the tensions and processes that are related to what marriage means for South Asians generally. One of the difficulties in speaking about these issues is naturally that South Asia is a huge, huge geographical area, and in terms of the population, it is a huge, huge variety of people who live in this area. And as you can imagine, there are quite a lot of differences in the way family relations and kinship relations are made to work in different parts of this area for many reasons. But then on the other hand, there are certain commonalities we can talk about. And I'm trying to stress these common features, even though sometimes it is a bit difficult and sometimes you feel that it is necessary also to point out how different things are in some places also. And generally, during this lecture, please feel free to interrupt and ask any clarifications or questions or present your thoughts so that we can have some exchange of ideas. So just raise your hand and then so that I notice. First of all, I don't know actually how much you have covered this kind of general picture of the South Asian region, but as we know, it is a very highly populated area with a very big population. I just figured out that it's about 1.6 billion people who live in South Asia at the moment, which is about 1 in 4 people in the world globally who live in this area. So we are talking about an extremely important part of the world, also from the global perspective, because of course such a huge population, such an important, very dynamic area at the moment, we have to take into account that it affects the whole world, the global situation as well in many ways. What happens there is important for everybody in the world. So I hope I can manage to bring up some important issues related to the family and kinship from the perspective of this important area. And well, maybe I can just mention that there is this green map is actually made according to some one of the United Nations offices uses this kind of definition of South Asia, which is not usually used. The difference to other definitions is that Iran is there included in South Asia, but mostly Iran is not included as a kind of geographical definition of South Asia, apart from some UN offices. So mainly it is usually Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Nepal, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Maldives, Bhutan, sorry, I forgot. Anyway, so these are the countries. And if you think of the population, India is naturally the biggest in terms of population and land area. 1.2 billion people live in India. And then the next one is, I think, Pakistan. It's about 185 million people. And Bangladesh, if I remember right, 160 million. And the population of Nepal, 25 or something. I actually don't remember exactly the figure, but anyway, it is in that proportion anyway. So India is a huge country. And India is going to be the most populous country in the world within the coming 10 years. It's going to surpass China, the population of China, according to the population forecasts or projections. And now when we turn to the issue of family and kinship in this area, there is a kind of mainstream, rather ideological way of thinking about this, which is commonly coming up in different kinds of discussions, even though maybe not so many social scientists anymore subscribe to this way of thinking. But this is a kind of the big narrative that it is usually very often, especially in media coverage, it is thought or implied that South Asia is a very traditional area where the society is kin-based, the way of thinking is collectivist, and it's very patriarchal in social relations between women and men. And then there is an idea that this also is reflected in the kinship structures. And then when society modernizes and industrializes, these features start to change towards wider individualization, and the family structures start to turn to more nuclear-like, and the gender relations become more egalitarian. But this big narrative of modernization naturally isn't really very good presentation or interpretation of realities when you go down to the level of what happens actually. This is not what helps us to understand what's going on too much, because there are certain features which are maybe happening related to this kind of narrative of development or modernization, but on the other hand there are many kind of other parts that are happening, other ways of changes are happening that we should also pay a lot of attention to, and which are of course very interesting from the cultural and social point of view. And I try to little bit bring up some of these kind of variations and alternative routes which are happening at the moment there. Then thinking about what kind of forces are in action in the South Asian society, and partly of course naturally elsewhere, which are maybe transforming social relations there. Some important processes are underway, which of course we have to keep in mind in order to understand what's happening there. First of all, there is the growing urbanization, which you will hear more about later, so maybe I shouldn't go in any detail to that, but anyway, it's good to notice that South Asia has this far been a very, let's say, relatively very rural area compared to many other areas of low-income countries. But then on the other hand, this urbanization process is becoming much faster and taking new turns. Then one of the issues which is very much reflected in the field of families is that women's educational standards are growing. Women are getting more and more educated, and earlier it used to be very clearly so that boys get more education than girls, but now this is shifting, so the situation is changing fast. Then I'm mentioning here the growing importance of education, and especially the expenses related to, or the costs of education. That is a very important issue reflected in how families live and how they are formed, because education is not for free, but it's mostly, well, basically in many South Asian countries you can also have a free education in government schools, but even when it is free you have to anyway have some money for all kinds of necessities and tuition fees, additional tuition fees, etc., that are necessary for schooling, and everyone who can afford would prefer to have their children in private education institutions. So this means that there are expenses related to educating children, and consequently For example, the number of children has to be limited in order to secure your children a good education. And so it affects, for example, this family formation and birth rates. Then again, consumerism. This has, of course, very different effects and very many different ways of affecting families. But here, for example, we can refer to the effect of growing consumerist aspirations of people, which affect, for example, marriage payments and dowries, etc. They affect the ways how people think about marrying and marriage and what marriage is all about and what is related to forming a marriage alliance. But there are also other ways how consumerism can affect families, but that's one of the important effects. Then globalization and mobility. There are again many different features related to that, but then especially this mobility issue, for example, the fact that people move in and out of India much more than before, also has its effects on how relationships are formed, what kind of models of conjugal life, for example, people have, etc., what kind of expectations. And then I'm mentioning here also demographic processes. They are very, let's say, macro level features of society and of the population. And I will later tell a little bit more about some demographic effects and on marriage, for example, how the composition of the population in terms of age and sex affects kinship and family. But more on that later, because it needs a little bit explanation. What does it mean? But this is the kind of most general level social change where also family relations change. Now then, we can talk a little bit about what is a kin-based society. It is often said that South Asian societies are kin-based societies. Or those of you who study ethnology or anthropology aren't naturally aware of and familiar with this kind of concept, but I suppose not all of you are students of these subjects, so it's necessary a little bit to explain what this means and what it means particularly in the context of South Asian societies. This is used as a kind of counterpoint, or kind of the opposite of the Western kind of societies. But here I would not like to build too much on that kind of dichotomy. But anyway, I would like to speak about this idea of kin-based society in South Asia, because that's actually how the societies there work. And I just made here a kind of graphical way of trying to explain how these things work and what does this kin-based society mean in South Asia. There are kind of different features of the social system which are interlinked and affecting each other, that they and also depending on each other. Like, for example, we have this idea of, like, in which is the most prevalent form of reckoning descent in South Asia, it's a patrilineal descent systems where people gain their social position as a member of a lineage running from father to son and so on through the links between male members of the family. And this is the kind of backbone of the society, that everyone gains his or her position in society through this cooperation of patriline. And this is the fundamental issue there. There are also other kinds of kinship systems in some parts of South Asia and in some social groups, in some caste groups, in some areas, in some ethnic groups, but they are kind of they live on their own right, but they are a minority. They are a kind of different than the majority of social groups. So that's why I'm kind of stressing this patrilineality there. And then we have marriage, which is a kind of way of regenerating or reproducing the patrilines. Marriage is necessary in order for the kin groups to thrive and to stay alive, because they need an alliance to others through marriage in order to have new members of their lineages in the future. And there are rather a lot of rules and regulations about marriage in kin-based societies, generally speaking, and in patrilineal societies, maybe even more than in some other systems. Then again, I have mentioned here caste, which is a kind of third very important part of this whole system in South Asia, even though not in all South Asian countries caste is such an important social phenomenon as in India, but some type of caste-like social groups you can find in all South Asian societies in one way or the other. Their interpretations and social meanings can be a bit different, but this is anyway a rather common way of understanding social groups and social relations between groups in South Asia. And caste is again reproduced through marriage, because you can't keep up a distinct caste group without a regulated marriage system, so to say. Caste determines who you can marry, and who you marry also determines caste as a phenomenon and as a group. So these all three things, like the lineage system, marriage system and caste system, they are all interlinked and depending on each other for their existence. So it's a kind of holistic system. And then I have put there this economy and politics, because I could have added some other things too. I'm sure there are many features that relate to this kin system or depend on it or are affecting it. But economy and politics, they are one of the most important ones, because politics in South Asia is also linked to these castes or other like social formations. They determine who holds political power, who votes for whom, to a large extent, even though not maybe necessarily always, but it affects a lot of the politics and kind of social development from the political perspective. And then the economy is also affected by this, because let's say, to put it in a very simplistic way, it is to say that who does business with whom depends on kinship relations, marriage and lineage relations, and other forms of social relatedness. Economy is not separate from families and kinship in South Asia. Here in Western countries, like in Finland, we are used to thinking that economy is a field totally separate from family, mostly. Well, we have some, like, of course, we know we have family corporations, etc., but they are a kind of exception, that the family is the kind of economic unit of society. But in South Asia, this is the kind of totally opposite to that. It is more to say that it is an exception to have economic activity which doesn't somehow depend on family and kin relations. And here a little bit more about what does it really mean that a society is a kin-based society. And this is these are some very general features that can be, I suppose, found in most parts of South Asia and also in some other areas. Like in many Middle Eastern societies, you have a lot of the same way of thinking because they also tend to have these patrilineal systems, etc. Kin group or family is important, first of all, because it determines your rights to land or other resources. So your economic activities are dependent on with whom do you belong together through your kin relations. You can't act as an economic agent, so to say, without taking into account what is your lineage or your kin group. Then another issue is social security. In these societies, you have very minor social security independent of kinship. Very few formal systems of social security. And this is, of course, very much in contrast to, for example, European societies. If you are hit by unemployment, if you have a serious illness, if you become widowed or if you meet up with some big bad accident or whatever happens, you can only rely on people with whom you are related, mostly. That is to say that actually you can't always rely on their help because it's not, sometimes the help you expect from your relatives is not forthcoming. So there are situations when you are left to suffer even without help, but that's the only way you can at least hope to receive some help in a difficult situation. That you have these networks in your kin groups where you can go and ask for help. And then another thing related to that is that in order to receive help, you also have to give help. And you have to also show deference to your kin group. You also have to help them. You have to build up your own position in that kin group by adjustable. That you have to adjust to many things. You have to think about the totality of your kin group in order to also feel that in a moment of need you can also gain some help from them. So it's a give and take. And this means that in a kin group you have certain persons who have the position of power and who can decide over your individual will at times, but you have to kind of be prepared to subdue to certain, sometimes not very nice decisions of the elders of the kin group in order to show them deference and in order to be part of the group. And the idea is that as a member of a kin group, you can have sometimes also individual freedoms, but in order to gain them, you have to first earn it by your obedience and service to the group. That you don't have freedoms as an individual as your birthright, so to say, but you have to earn it by your service to others. And this is very visible, for example, if you think of women's life cycle in South Asian societies. You start from a very dependent and, let's say, in a way, unfree situation as a young girl, and you grow up, and then you have to kind of be prepared to adjust to many kind of difficult situations, to be prepared to accept that other people decide for you about many things, but then you can also, by doing so, you can move forward along your life cycle, and at some point you will also start to regain certain freedoms, because if you manage to follow the let's say the hoped for path of the womanly life cycle, at certain point you start to gain a position of authority yourself, so that when you finally have, for example, your own children, you are married, you will later on become a mother-in-law or maybe a grandmother. At that point, you are in a position of authority, and you have a lot of freedoms, actually. So it is a kind of process where people are expecting also to benefit from themselves, so to say. And it's, of course, that, for example, the European way of thinking about a person is very rights-based. We think that people have rights, or we tend to think so, let's say so, that people have rights, and this is, they have a, like every individual who is born has a certain basic rights, fundamental rights, and these should be equal to everyone. But then, in a kin-based way of thinking, this is not the case. The attention is more on obligations than on rights. It's a different frame of thinking. What I have now described is someone could say a very essentialist way of thinking about a kin-based society, and that is true. It is a very ideal, typical presentation of what's the way of thinking of kinship in such a system. And naturally, this is not enacted as it is according to this ideal type anywhere, because people are agents everywhere. They make use of the rules of the game, so to say, even in such very rather hierarchically ordered social systems. They try to find ways of doing things differently at times, etc. It's not so overpowering on people or actors. But then this kind of very ideal, typical presentation might help to understand the way of thinking which affects certain activities. But then, if we think of the current situation, a lot of things are changing in South Asia as elsewhere. And particularly education and urbanization are one of the important transformative processes there, which change this way of, or put pressure on this kind of kin-based way of thinking or acting. That it's under pressure. And now I have actually one short film, a part of film actually, that we could take a look at. This is this film was made by Janne Laiho, who is a Finnish filmmaker, and it's titled About Forming a Family. The film itself contains three different parts. Part of it was filmed in India, part of it was filmed in Taiwan, and part in Finland. But we can look at the part of it which was filmed in India, because we don't have enough time for the whole film. Anyway, we can take a look at that. And Janne Laiho was working on this film in relation to a project where I was also myself involved in. It's called Precarious Family Formation, and its intention was to compare the ways families are formed and the kind of changes that are happening in these three different locations, and to see what kind of pressures people are feeling on these issues. But let's see if this works out. One moment, I have to, because this is like 25 minutes, but we are not going to see except for this. Oh, sorry. Okay.
माझं लग्नाविषयी असं मत आहे, कमीत कमी 23 वर्षाच्या पुढे लग्न करावं, म्हणजे कसं आपलं कमीत कमी शिक्षण थोडंफार आपल्या याच्यानुसार पूर्ण होतं, मग नंतर आपण जर स्वतःचे कामधंदे लागल्यानंतर लग्न करावं, त्यानंतर आपल्या आर्थिक परिस्थितीचा विचार करून लग्न करावं. लग्न झाल्यानंतर कमीत कमी 2-1 वर्षानंतर मुलांचा विचार करावा, जेणेकरून आपण त्यांच्याविषयी त्यांना सांभाळणे वगैरे त्यांचं पालनपोषण करणे एवढं झाल्यानंतर त्यानंतर 2-1 वर्षानंतर पुढचा विचार करू परत तर असलं म्हणत. तर नातेवाईक शोध ते आपल्या रिलेशनमधले शोध आता आपले आपलं कमीत कमी म्हातारपणाच्या वेळेस आपला सांभाळ झाला पाहिजे, म्हणजे ते आपला पण आर्थिक दृष्टिकोनातून पुढचा विचार करावा. मुलांचं असं आहे की आपलं त्याविषयी प्रेम आहे, पुढे झाले पुढे शिकल्यानंतर ते आपले सांभाळ करतील, म्हातारपणे आपल्याला कमीत कमी सहारा देतील त्यानुसार. पुढे चालून आपला एकांत तर नाही राहू शकत ना, कोणतरी हवंच ना आपल्याला आधार म्हणून.
जॉईंट फॅमिलीमध्येच माझं पूर्ण 10-11 वर्ष निघून गेले, 11 वर्ष निघून गेले. माझं शिक्षण 10वी 12वी झालेले, पण पूर्ण घरामध्येच वेळ जातो माझा. आणि आई वडिलांनी पण ठरवलं की तुमच्या पसंतीवर आहे बा, असं पसंत पडलं. वडील आणि माझ्या आमच्या आता बहीण भाऊ आहेत सगळे, म्हणून मग ते आमचं नातं जवळच असल्यामुळं एक लगेच संबंध जुळून गेला आणि त्या नात्यातून मग आमचं लग्न ठरलं.
आणि मी फर्निचर काम करतो, फर्निचर बिझनेस. आणि बस या आता काम चालू आहे इथं या ठिकाणी. शक्यतोवर माझं काम आउटडोअर असतं मॅडम, पूर्ण आउटडोअर. क्वचित एखाद्या वेळेस घरी काम आलं तर घरी आम्ही काम करतो, पण शक्यतोवर आउटडोअरच काम असतं. त्याच्यामुळे घरी जास्त काम करण्याचा प्रश्न येत नाही, घरातलं काम करण्याचा प्रश्न येत नाही. म्हणून घरातले कामं सर्व माझी पत्नी बघते सर्व. आणि शक्यतोवर आमच्या मोठ्या वहिनी आहे, आमच्या भावाच्या वहिनी, भावाची पत्नी, त्या आणि या दोघी मिळून अगदी घरातलं काम करत असतात दोघी पण. लग्नाचा विचार तसा मॅडम, ज्यावेळेस मी नाशिकला आलो ना त्यावेळेस माझ्या मनात तसा विचार नव्हता लग्न करण्याचा, पण थोडंसं आमच्या घरामध्ये वारकरी संप्रदाय जे अर्थात आमच्या घरामध्ये पंढरपूरची वारी, आळंदीची वारी या वारी आहे, आणि या माध्यमातून मी कीर्तनकार होण्यास ठरलो होतो लग्नाच्या आधी, उत्कृष्ट कीर्तनकार व्हायचं. पण कर्मधर्म संयोगाने मी एक वादक झालो चांगला. आता मी तबला वाजवतो, मृदंग वाजवतो, हार्मोनियम वाजवतो. आणि असं वाटल्यानंतर मला का आता लग्न काही करू नये. पण मग लग्न ते आमचे आता हिचे वडील आले आमच्या घरी. त्यावेळेस आम्ही भाड्याच्या रूममध्ये राहत होतो. हिचे वडील आले, ते म्हणे मला मुलगा पसंत आहे का, लग्न करायचं का बाबा तुम्हाला. मग म्हणे मग म्हटलं ठीक आहे बघा तुमची काय इच्छा असेल म्हणून. आणि म्हणून मग मी होकार दिला. त्यावेळेस होकार दिल्यानंतर मग ते आले, बघून गेले मला आणि आमचं लग्न ठरलं आणि लग्न झालं. मग
16-17 वर्षात माझं लग्न झालं. आणि ह्या बाबतीत मला काहीच माहिती नव्हतं की मुलं कसे होता, ही मुलं लग्न कसं का करतात. त्यामुळं मला हे ज्ञान नसल्यामुळं मला थोडं हे झालं, प्रॉब्लेम आला. यांना सर्व ज्ञान होतं, म्हणजे जेंट्सला सगळं नॉलेज असतं, लेडीजला मला काहीच नॉलेज नव्हतं. नंतर ते ज्ञान नसल्यामुळं मुलगा पण थोडा हे झाला. पहिला मुलगा थोडा नॉर्मल मुलांपेक्षा थोडा अलग झाला. मग नंतर थोडं ज्ञान वाढत गेलं माझं. हे मुलं असे होतात जे आपण आपल्या नैतिक संबंधातून मुलं निर्माण होतात. तर ते मुलं मग नंतर मला ज्ञान आलं की हे मुलं अशा प्रकारे होतात, असं लग्न याच्यासाठी करतात. मग दुसऱ्या मुलाच्या वेळेस मी व्यवस्थित ट्रीटमेंट घेतली. पहिल्यापासनं जे आपलं पहिल्या महिन्यापासनं तिथे 9व्या महिन्यापर्यंत आणि डिलेवरी पण व्यवस्थित झाली. मग मला म्हणजे मी 6-6व्या महिन्यामध्ये मी 250 किलोमीटर चालत गेली होती ह्या मुलाच्या वेळेस. पांडुरंगाच्या आशीर्वादाने मला दोन्ही पण मुलं व्यवस्थित झाले आणि पहिल्या मुलाचं पण व्यवस्थित हे झालं, तो वारला. नंतर हा मुलगा झाला, ही मुलगी झाली. मग नंतर मी फॅमिली ऑपरेशन ते ऑपरेशन करून टाकलं. कारण मला असं वाटतं की भारतातली लोकसंख्या भरपूर आहे, खूप आहे, आणि त्यामुळं मुलगा होऊन होणार नाही असं माझ्या डोक्यात आहे. भारतीय संस्कृती अशी आहे की पुरुष प्रधान असल्यामुळं मुलगा हा पाहिजेच.
मुलगा होणं म्हणजे ह्या फक्त वंशाला दिवा पाहिजे बघ, म्हणून मुलगा व्हावा असं वाटत होतं. कारण की आमच्या भारतीय संस्कृतीमध्ये असं आहे की ज्याला मुलं होत नाही त्याला जग नाव ठेवतं, अर्थात त्याला कुचक्या म्हणून बोलतात, असं वाईट बोलतात लोक. म्हणून कमीत कमी एक मुलगा व्हावा आणि तो वंशाला दिवा असावा म्हणून एक मुलगा होणं गरजेचं आहे. बस
okay, the film turns to Taiwan next, and I don't think we are going to watch that one. Okay, I will just no. Let's go back to this one. So in that film you might have had a glimpse on the way people think about marriage. There were many other things too, but maybe the issues related to marriage and then the extended family, what it means, also came through. there were actually two interviewees from two different families. The first one was a auto rickshaw driver, an unmarried young man who was planning to get married, and then this other one, which was a couple from another family. They are married and they are living in this, what is called here, a joint family, a household where there are like families of two brothers living together with their father. So there are three generations and at least two nuclear family units, like the nuclear family units of these two brothers who are sharing the same household. And joint family is a phenomenon that very many people in India talk about, and sometimes it is talked about in a little bit different meaning than what is this social, let's say, sociological way of, or anthropological way of defining it. Sometimes people just use it in a very loose sense, especially in South Asia, just referring to wider extended families. Extended family is a kind of larger group of different kinds of families which are not nuclear, and they can be joint families or stem families. These are kind of subgroups of extended family. And a stem family is a family of three generations, meaning that there is the grandparents or grandfather or grandmother with his or her son, and the son's children or the son's wife and children living together, so that there are three generations. And we can say that this kind of extended family living is a generally shared ideal of family life in most of South Asia. People see this as a kind of ideal arrangement, that people are living not in nuclear families but in bigger units. However, even though it is an ideal, if we take any point of time see in what kind of households are people actually living, in any point of time you don't see a majority of people living in this kind of extended family arrangements. The majority of people tend to be living in nuclear family units anyway, despite this ideal. And this has actually kind of demographical reasons why this is so, because if we just take a slice of time, just depicts that moment. But if we take a look at the kind of life cycle of people, then we see that many people at some particular point of time in their life usually live in an extended family, because it's one moment in their life cycle when this extended family is the way of living or arranging your household. That is so that when someone gets married, usually after that marriage they tend to be living together with the husband's parents. That means a patrilocal living arrangement. And then the issue, how long this situation lasts, varies in different parts and in different socioeconomic groups and classes and castes. But anyway, mostly during the beginning of a marriage, people share the household with the husband's parents, and maybe also the husband's brothers and brothers' nuclear units. So for a certain time, this is the case. But then when time passes, usually children are born and grow, and also the older couple starts to get older and older, and usually at some point, these kind of extended families tend to start to separate. There are different kinds of internal tensions usually that lead to this, because in an extended or joint family, usually the people share also certain kind of economic assets. For example, they have a shared land holding, no matter who is officially possessing the land, but they might be farming one farm together, and usually the old father is the one who has the decision-making power over what happens with the land or with the enterprise or whatever they are running. And there are in any way internal tensions, because people start to be thinking about their own nuclear unit more and more when they grow. When the children grow, they start to be thinking that, why should I contribute to the whole household? Why can't I reserve more resources for my own son's education or for this or for that? And the people start to get all kinds of conflicts within these kind of households. And then at some point, usually they divide. And then it forms several nuclear families or a number of nuclear families and maybe one stem family where the old couple or the grandfather or grandmother is going to stay. So it's kind of nucleates in this way. And then there is a new cycle starting when their children grow. At some point the sons get married and bringing their own wives. And then again we have this stem family or a joint family. So this is a kind of life cycle of the household that we are talking about. And if we think that in a let's say there is an old couple who have, let's say, three sons, and all these three sons marry, when this household at some point divides or separates into nuclear families, this old couple can only live together usually with one of the sons. So it means that only one son will have a stem family, and then these two others will have a nuclear family. So this is a kind of demographic explanation why it is actually rather impossible for everyone to be living in a joint or stem family at any given point of time. I don't know if you get the idea, but anyway, so it depends for which perspective we look at the thing. If we look at it as a kind of point in time, or whether we look at the cycle of household development or life cycle, let's say so. But then it's also another issue whether people actually live in this kind of extended households, and what is another issue, what is the role of these extended family relationships to their life? Because sometimes even despite having separate households, these kin relations can have a lot of importance for people's decisions and even everyday life. So we should take into account that it's not only necessary to look at the household structures, like how people form their households, but we should also look at the relationships and how they are affected by these family ties. And that kind of family ties are wider family ties are very resilient in South Asian context, that even if people live separately, even if they live in nuclear families, they tend to have these important kin relations that affect their life. Here I have just put a picture of this is a kind of comic picture of a middle class extended or joint family. I can't say for sure which type is this. Maybe this is a joint family anyway, depicted in a rather funny way. But this is a middle class family for sure, because they have a dog, and this is not that tells you that this is a middle class family if it is an Indian family. Because it only is part of the middle class life to have pet dogs. And patrilocality is a very important phenomenon in South Asia, in most societies there, meaning that living arrangement is with the husband's natal family. After marriage, a young bride moves to live with the husband's parents. That has very important repercussions for women's lives, because especially in areas where people where women tend to be married off to total strangers, to other villages, to other areas, sometimes even to quite far away places. This means that the women, when they marry, they have to leave back their natal relatives and natal family and move to a faraway place, live among strangers. But this is an issue which differs in different parts of South Asia, because there are areas where it is much more common also for women to marry within the same village, or you have marriages between relatives, like cousin marriages among South Asian Hindus and among Muslims everywhere in South Asia. So this is not always the same kind of arrangement for all women. But this issue of marrying to a family that is totally unknown to yourself is the prevalent practice in parts of North India, especially. Let's say Hindu North India, because among Muslims you have a bit different practices. Then something about marriage, generally. It is often said that marriage is a sacred right in India. And of course, in many societies, marriage is sacred. That's nothing so especially South Asian, but in South Asia it is particularly full with all kinds of symbolic and ritual meanings. So it's really pregnant with different kinds of connotations and symbolic references. Especially if you have attended a wedding there, you can say that it is full of ritualistic elements which are sometimes very unintelligible to outsiders. But why marriage is so central in South Asia? It is very, very importantly central there, because as in any lineage-based society, that is the building block of the lineage. Marriage alliance is the alliance between two different kin groups, and it has a lot of economic, political, social, in addition to emotional consequences, not only to the couple themselves, but to the kin groups around them, to very many people. It determines, for example, who can give gifts to certain people, who is supposed to give gifts, who is supposed to receive gifts, and who is supposed to show deference to whom, and who is supposed to be received as an important guest. And there are many different issues, and who is going to cooperate with whom, etc. It has a lot of important meanings. But maybe we can't go too much in detail into that. But now a few features about marriage in South Asia generally. And there are also now some figures about India, which I know the best. Anyway, there are issues related to the commonness of marriage, how common it is. There are issues related to who you should marry, and there are issues related to in what way you should choose the partner. Anyway, marriage is nearly universal in South Asia, and especially in India, and also in Pakistan and Bangladesh. In Nepal, I'm not quite sure if it is so overwhelmingly universal, but maybe even there. I'm just not maybe aware of it enough to say. But in India, it's extremely rare for anyone to remain unmarried for life. Like, if you look at the men who are aged 50, 1% of them has never been married. And if you look at the women at the age of 50, it's even less than 1% who never married. taking into account the fact that there are people, for example, who have some, let's say, some kind of physiological problems or severe illnesses, or who are invalid in one way or another, or who, or there are people of sexual minorities. Taking all this into account, it's really astonishing. How is it possible that practically everyone gets married in India? But the fact is that it is considered as parents one of the most important duties of parents to see that their children can get married, or that they get married, actually. And this is why, no matter what is the situation of your child, parents do their utmost to arrange a marriage for their children, no matter what is the child's situation. And there are a lot of social sanctions against remaining unmarried, to the people themselves, and also to their, or even maybe more, actually, especially in rural societies, even more so towards their parents, because they will be severely looked down upon if the parents didn't make sure that their children got married. The idea is that the person who never got married is kind of, who actually didn't become an adult, because it's necessary to be married in order to be a fully adult person. This relates to the personhood, the concept of personhood, that if you never married, you are kind of, you have remained in a kind of liminal situation, in a way. You haven't entered the full adulthood. And then again, most of the marriages, the majority of marriages have been and still are arranged marriages. This means that there are other people than the couple themselves who importantly influence in the making of the match between the people. And arranged marriages are valued, and they are also accepted by most people, also by most young people. Of course, there are certain categories of people, like highly educated urban elites or higher middle class people, who might not be thinking, not all of them are thinking this way, but the majority of people, generally speaking, accept arranged marriage as the ideal, a good way of arranging a marriage. And related to this system of arranged marriages is the fact that in especially in India, but growingly also I know that in Bangladesh, in Pakistan, I'm not so sure about, or Nepal, I'm not so sure about how universal is a dowry practice, but dowry is part of this system, that a marriage is arranged, and as part of the marriage arrangements, dowry is determined. That means dowry means that the girl's parents and family pay an amount of money, or give some very valuable gifts that are kind of agreed upon in advance to the boy's family. Dowry doesn't go to the boy himself, it goes to the boy's family. But because of the idea of the lineage property, so to say, of course the son also benefits from this dowry that the parents get. And then again, there are also very strong prescriptions about who you can marry. If marriages are arranged, of course there is the possibility of choosing what kind of person would you like to have as a son-in-law or a daughter-in-law. First and most important is the, let's say, religious endogamy, which is the most commonly practiced, that you should be from the same religious background, there is the caste endogamy or ethnic endogamy, meaning that it is mostly arranged for the spouses to come from the same caste or same caste category. But later I will tell you a little bit more about this. And then one of the very important issues nowadays is the educational standard of the boy and the girl, or the woman and the man. Usually a woman would be married off to a man who has at least the same education that she has, or a higher education. But there are also exceptions to this, which we will come later. A man can have a wife who is less educated, but that is not kind of the same for women and men. And then there is an idea that there should be an age difference between the spouses, so that it should be in the range of 3 to 5 years. That's the most common. Sometimes it is more, rather rarely it is less, but anyway, sometimes it is less, sometimes it is more, but this is the kind of most usual, the kind of age difference that people strive for.
Is that what isogamy means?
Isogamy, it means like you come from the same educational level, that you marry the same, like if a woman is a graduate, the husband is also a graduate, that you marry in the same level. And hypergamy means that you marry up, so that the husband would be, for a woman's hypergamy is that you marry a more educated, and hypogamy means you marry somebody who is below your own educational standard. Okay, yes.
Isn't the concept applied also to other positions, like not just education, but caste and class?
Yes, you can also talk about it in that same, yes, you can use it for other social characteristics, like class or caste. Also, well, caste is a bit different, because then you would talk about endogamy and exogamy mostly, but well, you can use it for describing if you have somebody from a, let's say, trading caste who would marry to somebody who is from a ex-untouchable group or something, like a scheduled caste, then you would say that is a hypogamous, how to pronounce this in English, marriage. Yes, yeah, you could use that actually. Yes, that's right. But then, despite all these kind of ideals and what people will tell you, if you ask them, they will all tell you, no, nothing else is possible than to marry within your own caste, and you should have this kind of very closely scrutinized spouse, that you have to have this and these qualities. But then in practice, actually, there is a lot of changes happening that are visible if you look around in India. And in fact, there isn't very much of very reliable information about how people actually marry, for example, in India. People are always interested to know that, okay, you have these arranged marriages, but you have also these so-called love marriages, which means it's like marriage by own choice. You have that kind of marriages too, so they are becoming more common. So how common they are actually? But nobody can really say that very, very convincingly, because it's, first of all, it's difficult to find out. If you ask people in a big survey that, okay, you got married last year, was it an arranged marriage, or was it a love marriage, or what was it? So people will tell you something, but actually what is that arranged marriage has a lot of social value. It's the norm. So you can't always rely on what people would tell you in these kind of surveys, etc., because they might not want to tell you how that marriage took place.
May I comment?
Yes.
On this kind of difficulty of definition.
Yes, yes, that's another thing. Yes.
Want to say that they made their own choice, but still there's a strong influence of the parents at the relatives there. So you cannot really know surely how
Very good point, and this is exactly the other reason why it is very difficult to say how is this marriage situation or marriage scenario changing because of this, because the definitions change and how people would explain it. And this is what you are explaining, it's a kind of in-between type of marriage arrangement is becoming more and more common, especially in urban areas. That the young people themselves have some say on it, that they might have got to know each other, they have an interest in maybe marrying this other person, then they go to their parents or other relatives and say that I know this one person, and why don't you go and find out if we could marry? And okay, if that person is formally, so to say, a suitable partner, maybe the parents go and send somebody to ask about it. And so it can be kind of half arranged and half love or own choice, whatever. Or otherwise it can be so that the parents introduce their daughter or son to somebody which they think that this person could be a good candidate for a son-in-law or daughter-in-law, and then they leave it to the young people themselves to find out if this will work out. What do they think about it, or how does it look from their perspective? So what is that? It is something in between. It's not so straightforward and kind of cut into two, either or. But then there are a few surveys which have found out about the general picture in India, for example. How is it that marriages are arranged? In this one survey, which is from 2005, they didn't ask if it is an arranged or what kind of marriage it is, but they recorded or asked about whether it is an intercaste marriage or interreligious marriage, whether the spouses come from different castes or different religions. And actually there were not so many marriages that are like this, because in so to say pure love marriages, which are fully kind of based on the young people's own choice, they often tend to be intercaste or interreligious. Not all of them, but naturally, but anyway, or let's say so that if there is an intercaste marriage, the probability that it is some kind of love marriage is quite high, especially in some areas of, for example, India, but not always. We will see about that one also later a little bit more. But then there are also, even within India, if you look at different regions or different states, you can see quite a lot of difference. Like if you look at Punjab and Rajasthan, which are two neighboring states anyway, they are quite different in many respects. And if you look at them, like in Rajasthan, you have very few intercaste marriages, less than 2% of the marriages. These marriages were from the younger generation. And in Punjab, it was more than 12%, which is not that small figure anyway, that are inter-caste, between members of different caste groups. Let's see how much time we have. Should we take a look at this? Okay, let's not take a look at this. There was a small video about love marriages and what young people think about them and what they see as the good sides of love marriages and good sides of arranged or marriages.
How long is it?
It's not very long, but let's take a look.
It.
It's not a long, it's just a clip, that kind of it's sorry.
Hi. probably love, yeah.
I think arranged marriages are pretty cool.
I'm gay.
I would definitely say love marriages.
I feel love marriage is better.
I will say I don't even believe in marriage.
Arranged marriage.
I think love marriages are better. It's someone that you choose rather than your family choosing for you.
Both the girl and the boy can know each other better, and they know their priorities and everything. They know their likes, dislikes, and also they can understand better.
My parents had a love marriage and had to fight to a certain extent for what they had. And I feel because of that they're closer and they have a stronger connection.
They're better compatible, they have checked all the checkpoints before. Arranged marriage is like more of a blind game.
That is the tradition and that is how we have gotten born and brought up.
And I wouldn't mind settling for a guy who my mom chooses because she knows best what is for me and she knows me like through and through.
A piece of paper will never say that you're married or you're not. So if you're compatible with your partner, you can stay with your partner, you trust your partner, then fine, go for marriage or whatever. But then that's more important, understanding and compatibility.
I don't think I can choose either of the options. Because I'm gay and it's illegal for me to get married, so if I would be getting married, it would be a crime.
Love marriages which get arranged is good, because just love marriage is that just if parents are not good at with the choice of the husband or wife, then problems arise, then fights happen.
A lot of noise from that one, but that maybe shows that just how different points of view young people also have. I think that was filmed in some, I don't know, Mumbai or some big city anyway, so where young people have strong opinions pro and against. Okay, but we have too little time. I will jump this. It takes too much time to explain. That was basically just about the fact that even though this endogamy is the ideal that you should marry within your own caste group, actually there are quite... It's about maybe 10% of people are actually married outside of their own caste group. This was some data from a big survey, another one. It was just shown there. And actually there was another one about the educational standard. Even though it's usually in India said that a woman can never marry somebody who is less educated, actually nearly 1 in 10 women are married in that kind of marriage. Nobody usually would see that as a possibility because it's a very strong kind of norm there that... A woman just... A man wouldn't marry a woman who is more educated. It is not good. That doesn't lead to a good solution. But actually that kind of marriages do exist in India. Okay. So the norms and the practice differ to some extent. And it is of course possible that even earlier there was some difference between the norms and the practice, but... It's possibly also so that people are more free to express this kind of unnormative ways of marrying than before. And then why these kind of marriages against the norms take place more and more? Part of the picture is that it's related to the so-called marriage squeeze, which refers to a kind of demographic situation where there is no equal number of marriageable women and men in a population, where you have a kind of too few potential spouse candidates to choose from, so that it inevitably leads to some sort of solution. You have to invent some way of finding a spouse in that kind of situation. We are actually starting to run out of time soon, but I will try to explain a little bit about this, because this relates to some research I've been carrying out recently, and it's about this marriage squeeze and about how does it affect marriage. The thing is that in Indian society you have sex selective abortions. Let's see. In certain areas of India, not everywhere. You can't really read the numbers here, but just look at the colors. In the red areas and orange areas, you have an imbalanced number of boys and girls, so showing that the practice of sex selection takes place in pregnancy, so that if a woman is expecting a girl, they tend to, some of them have an abortion and try for another time for a boy. And this leads in the population level into imbalanced sex ratios among children. And in the green areas you have a balanced sex ratio more or less. So you don't have this problem everywhere in India. But in Punjab, Haryana, in areas around Delhi and in Uttar Pradesh and in Western India, in Maharashtra and Gujarat, where you have actually the in those areas where that are economically very, very advanced, you tend to have this problem more than elsewhere in India. And because this has been going on now for about 20 years, more or less, this means that it is reflected in the numbers of boys and girls in the population, and then affecting in the marriageable age, and then it affects the opportunities to marry. And in certain areas there are not enough girls to marry. This is the same problem you have in some East Asian societies, some areas of China, in Korea, Taiwan, in some other societies too. So this means that marriage practices are under pressure to change because of this. And this is a picture, unfortunately you can't see it in this light. It would need a darker room to see, but this is a picture taken from a car through the windscreen. And this is a truck, back of a truck, and it says, of course, blow horn, like in India, all the truck backs are having this text, blow horn, meaning that you have to show the sign if you want to pass. But then there is a Hindi text there which says, as translated, if girl child is brutally killed, then where will we get brides from? So this just shows that there is a growing awareness of this problem, that if people are not willing to have daughters, how is it going to affect the marriage prospects of their own sons later on? So there is a growing kind of awareness, but this awareness hasn't this far managed to remove the problem yet. Let's say so. Okay, let's just jump this because there is not enough time to explain all of this, but because they are demographics and require quite a lot of explanation. Anyway, so there are demographers who have carried out analyses of the situation in terms of the national population, for example, in India, and trying to make a projection of the future situation. And, for example, this one French demographer made a very complicated projection of the situation, and it shows that if the sex selection ends in the form it has been carried out this far in India, if it's finished, if it's kind of got rid of, so that we don't have that problem there anymore, even then, 10% of men aged 50 in the year of 2050 will be never married. So it is quite a lot more than the 1% that is never married at the moment. But then on the other hand, if this sex selection continues as in the level it is at the moment in India as a whole, that means that nearly one in four men will remain unmarried by 2050, because there is, it's a rather, okay, I will not go into all these details, but it's a very complicated issue, how the population growth and changes in it, for example, also contribute to this problem. And when you have this kind of sex selection, even if it ends, it doesn't end the problem, because this will, the existing imbalance in the young cohorts of people, like boys and girls, if there is an imbalance now, it will affect the population for many decades in the future, because this imbalance remains there, and it not only affects that imbalanced generation themselves, but also the younger ones, because it makes it more difficult for the younger ones to marry, because some of the men will try to marry women who are younger, from younger cohorts, from younger age groups. So it kind of has a very deep effect on the marriage prospects, not only for those who are in that imbalanced age group themselves.
What do you think of the future of sex selection in South Asia?
Well, I think that it's going to spread to new areas, because it's related to this kind of economic aspirations of families. It's partly related to that. So it will spread to those areas that are kind of advancing economically, to new areas. But then on the other hand, there are luckily, at least at the moment, some signs of the practice becoming less common in some of these core areas, like in Punjab and Haryana, where it has been very common, because the sex ratios have started to become a little bit better among the children there. So it seems that there is some change happening. Nobody can really this far say, why is it so? Why have people really started to think? or what is the reason? Or is it because they have become more scared of being accused of doing this? Or what's the reason? Nobody has this far been able to really explain it, but there is a little bit of improvement in some areas. So I think it will, in some areas the situation it will start to improve, and in some other areas it's going to worsen. So it's everything put together, it's difficult to say how long it will last for it to really to get rid of this problem, let's say so, because at some point it's going to end for sure. But then on the other hand, in the meantime, it can create a huge effect on society. Even if it ends, it will have an effect. And because of this phenomenon, it has its effects very differently towards different parts of society. And I did some research with a statistician or mathematician, Sangeeta Kulathinal, and what we did was that we found out how different educational groups and different states are differently affected by the situation. Those who are from the, well, usually we can say just very generally that the men who are the least educated and from the socioeconomically lowest groups, they are the worst hit by this situation. When, so to say, women become scarce, they are the ones who are remaining without wives. And for the highly educated, the situation is not that bad. Okay, let's not get into all this. But then, if there is this situation of imbalanced numbers of men and women in marriageable ages, some kind of solution will come up. At the moment, nearly everyone is getting married in India and also in other parts of South Asia. Oh, and I should say that this same problem is not that much evident in other parts of South Asia. Like in Pakistan and Bangladesh, you don't have this problem in the same proportion, at least. And even in India, among Muslims, the situation is better. They don't practice sex-selective abortion, unlike Hindus. Mostly, let's say so. Anyway, so in India, one of the solutions is that there are more unmarried people. Well, it's just society can just adjust to that. That's one possibility. Or otherwise, there can be also more and more of these different kinds of marriages, like intercaste marriage, marriages between different religious groups, or different regions and languages. And also the remarriage of widows and divorcees can become more common. At the moment, it's relatively rare for a widow or a divorcee to remarry in India. And then also the educational requirements for the spouse might change and become more flexible. And also age difference between spouses can have some kind of changes happening, so that people might be more find it more acceptable to marry a spouse with a larger age difference, or maybe even so that a woman is older than a man or whatever. Or then there can be marriage migration. This is already happening, for example, within India, so that some women are coming from other areas to these worst hit areas like Punjab to marry there. And then again, this dowry practice can be somewhat affected, and there can be a situation where also bride price starts to be practiced. It used to be practiced in some social groups and castes and tribes in India before, but it has nearly disappeared. But now it might be reintroduced in some parts of society, even though in a different form in a way, because it can also start to become kind of like buying a bride practice, like you pay to get a bride who is a kind of less valued daughter-in-law than a normal, so to say, daughter-in-law would be. That kind of practices can be created by the situation. Okay, but now we don't have time for all this. I will just see if there is. Okay, there were some pictures from my fieldwork site in Maharashtra, but we will just jump now to this last one, which is about the what's about the future. This is more generally, not only about marriage. That was what we had before, was about how marriage will change, but how this kin-centered way of life. Is it changing in South Asia generally because of all these wider social and demographic, etc. changes? We can say that this kin-centered way of life naturally will carry on in the area. It's very difficult to imagine that it would kind of change at least very quickly. But then on the other hand, there are certain changes. For example, the role of the nuclear family relations, it seems to be growing. Especially you can see this in middle-class families. You can see that there is a new way of thinking about the conjugal bond between a husband and wife. Because earlier it was thought so that this very close an intimate relationship between husband and wife was, from the perspective of the kin group, a kind of risk, let's say so, because it was a kind of destructive force if the couple had a very, very close and intimate personal relationship. There are certain ways of behavior in the kin groups, in the lineage way of thinking, which try to avoid this from emerging. Like, for example, in the rural areas, it is not regarded as proper for the young couple to spend time together in the daytime, especially if the elders are present. They are not even supposed to talk to each other in the presence of others. These are the kind of social systems or practices which try to avoid the creation of a very close conjugal relation. Intimate relation in the traditional kinship way of thinking. But now in the especially in middle class families, this is changing fast, or has been changing for quite a long time already. And then you can, as we talked about above this caste or ethnic endogamy is going to weaken, I'm sure. It's not going to be as important in the future as it used to be. But then on the other hand, this religious endogamy will remain very, the requirement of this type of endogamy seems to remain a very strong prescription, especially in India, because there are lots of political pressures related to religious issues, and it strengthens the demand of making sure that you don't marry outside of your own religious group. Okay, that one we already went through, this changes in dowry, and then this matchmaking, new forms of matchmaking will emerge as we talked about how these arranged and love marriage are kind of becoming mixed. And then again, divorce and remaining unmarried will certainly become more common in the future, it seems, than it used to be. Okay. And then there will be more diversification in the family systems of different socioeconomic and regional groups, I think so. Okay, I will end here. Sorry I couldn't manage to go through everything that I intended, but anyway.
Thank you very much.